I'd like to kick off this podcast with a sobering statistic. According to a recent Reuters Ipsos poll, 53% of Americans fear that AI could cost them or someone in their household their job. An Anthropic survey found an even higher percentage, 64%, were concerned about losing their job to AI. So AI is obviously causing a lot of concern, just as financial institutions are accelerating their investments in the technology. So this raises an important question. How do you deliver business value with AI at the same time you build trust with customers and employees? Now, that's just one of the big issues that we're going to tackle during our podcast, AI, Trust, and the Future of Banking, hosted by American Banker and sponsored by Q2. I'm Lisa Joyce, your guest host, and today I'm joined by Adam Blue. Adam is Chief Technology Officer at Q2. Now, Adam believes that AI, of course, has the power to change the lives of people, businesses, and financial institutions. And he's a passionate advocate about responsible innovation and using AI to amplify rather than replace humans. Adam, thanks for joining us for what I'm sure is going to be a very, very interesting conversation.
Absolutely. Happy to be here today, Lisa.
You know, I know, Adam, that you do think very deeply about these sorts of issues. But let me ask you, do you believe that fears about AI are they overblown? And what responsibility do financial institutions have to really thoughtfully manage AI's impact on their workforce?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. My opinion, because none of us really know whether fears are overblown or not, but my opinion, to be clear, is that the current set of media communications and communications from AI companies and the Valley in general, and a lot of, I'll just generously call them enthusiasts. Of course, people are going to be terrified. You know, we had Dario Amodei and Sam Altman tell us that there won't be any more white collar work, and Elon Musk runs around telling people not to bother saving for retirement because everybody's going to be on UBI. These are not outcomes, I think, that are necessarily outcomes that excite, in particular, the American workforce. So it makes a ton of sense that people would be upset. I think the most rational fear, in my opinion, is what I kind of call the reverse centaur model, where instead of like a human being on top of the body of a horse and getting to run fast and do awesome horse stuff, you end up being like the human body with a horse head stuck on you, and you got to run around eating grass and drinking out of streams. And so we could end up iterating towards a future in which human beings end up performing a lot of integrative, low-value tasks to feed AI that we decide can perform the more interesting, synergistic, or higher value work. And I think that's the outcome maybe that has a lot of folks concerned, is if I have a reasoning tool or a tool that performs inference, and I think that was part of my job and I was good at it, do I end up just shoveling data around and swivel chairing to try and keep these systems up and running? And do I become, kind of a gardener in an orchard where I don't particularly care for the trees or the fruit? Or can I maintain some of my agency and still have meaning in my work and have a handle on AI where I still get some level of autonomy and self-determination and you know, a sense of purpose in the work? And I think that's what a lot of these fears come down to.
Right. Do you think that financial institutions what responsibility do they have to thoughtfully manage AI's impact on their workforce?
Yeah, I think they have an extraordinary responsibility, because as a leader, you show up every day and you ask people to not do something else and instead do the work that they've committed to. And you make choices based on information that you don't always share all the way down to your employees for reasons of governance and compliance and propriety and business management philosophy. And you ask them for a differential effort. I know I do pretty frequently. And so it creates for a leader in an organization an extraordinary responsibility. And I don't mean to quibble with your framing in any way, but it's not the bank's responsibility. It's the leadership of the bank's responsibility to make sure that they can find a way through this technological upheaval in which their employees feel like they are doing meaningful work in a way that is aligned with the way they think about creating value in the world and the way they think about themselves, and that they share in some of the surplus that accrues as technology makes us more productive and more efficient and more effective.
Adam, American Banker did a survey and found that 60% of bankers consider AI a high strategic priority. And they named productivity improvements and workflow automation as their top use cases. Are those the right things to be focusing on? Are financial institutions missing opportunities where AI could maybe create even more value?
I think yes to both sub-questions. So those are some of the right things to be focused on. And they are, you know, it's obvious when you get a technology like AI that moves some of freeform text processing and neuro-linguistic capability into the machine space and out of the meat space, as I think of it. It seems natural to think, let's just do everything faster. Let's do it more efficiently. Let's trade off some expensive human labor for less expensive, you know, compute labor. The thing that I think is not being addressed as broadly is the opportunity to fix a different kind of problem. So workflow improvements, productivity, that stuff's all great. But one of my biggest frustrations with every commercial relationship I have is having to explain myself more than once. I feel like I am the bringer of context when I have a problem. And so if I have an issue with an airline flight, if I have an issue with a grocery delivery order, if I have an issue with my Time Warner internet service, I move through their organization chart and I bring the context with me. I'd prefer that that was the other way around. I'd prefer that these companies were using AI to broadly understand all of their customers at the level that the most intimate customer rep who had known me for years could understand me. So there's this notion on the Q2 side of things we're working on around what I call organizational memory. Brilliant organizations have strong organizational memory. If you think about like when you go out to eat, you know, my open table kind of identity and profile, it precedes me. And I have had comments from people who work in restaurants based on information that I've given a different restaurant during a visit. And it makes me feel like they know me a little better. And they don't really know me, but they have access to my profile that has a lot of interesting data in it. And they try and shape the experience based on what's in that profile. That's a pretty powerful concept. And I think it's changed the way that dining out really works for people if they use one of the platforms that creates that that kind of continuity in the story of you as a consumer. I think that banking as an industry could benefit very much from applying AI in the same way so that account holders don't have to feel like they have to show up and vomit up their context for every problem they have or every place they go. And we talk about personalization, we talk about long-term financial journeys, but generally the first question you get is, you know, who are you? Can you prove who you are and what are you trying to do? And I think there's a way to elevate that. And it's a more nebulous concept than, hey, let's get through KYC faster and make it easier to onboard customers, which again, I think has value. But solving the underlying problem of being in the right place with the right tone and the right service or product for your account holder, I think AI could have a massive impact on that. But we have a mountain of work to do to achieve that kind of payoff.
Right. I agree. I mean, there is a lot of organizational memory that's kind of hidden in banks, right? They're just not they're just not leveraging it.
Yeah. I think if you have customers that come to you and say, I want to talk to Bob or I want to talk to Stephanie, I think what they're telling you is not that Bob and Stephanie are you know, fantastically more effective employees. They're telling you that Bob and Stephanie have some incremental context over an average employee that's been pulled out of whatever, you know, service queue they're getting. And I think it's a signal that your organizational memory is not sufficient to the task of really delighting customers. That's kind of one of the signals I look for.
Great. You know, as we know, of course, there's lots of excitement, maybe even hype around AI, but much of it kind of still feels a little theoretical, right? I know you've talked about the boring work behind the shiny promise, meaning the unglamorous engineering and data infrastructure that determines what AI delivers. If I'm a banker and I'm listening to this podcast and I'm thinking, hey, my pilots aren't moving, what's the real conversation I should be having internally? I mean, where are financial institutions getting stuck?
Yeah, I think here's some questions you can ask. Are we trying to do too many things in parallel? That's the first one. Because that getting stuck probably means that the critical path for all these projects in your organization is coming back to the same four people, and they're probably already pretty busy. The second question I'd ask is, have you earned the right to apply AI to that workflow or process or problem? Do you really understand it? Have you done the fundamental analysis to understand the process flow and the structure? And have you edited that process to eliminate, you know, ineffective or even counterproductive steps? Because if you're not doing that, then don't just go rub AI on the problem. You know, we on the QT side, we're pretty advanced in our use of AI. We've leaned into it very, very hard over the last few years. And I will look at organization-wide readouts on where we are on applying AI to even just our internal processes, not even building products, which we're also doing. And I constantly see the same thing, which is my biggest risk is this other team of people isn't going to go clean up this data or produce this MTP interface or create a new API that we need to achieve this. And that underscores to me that you've got the resources maybe not applied in the right way. And so this is probably a consequence of doing too many things simultaneously, not leaning in on getting data and data workflows and fundamental data engineering worked out, and not really understanding and curating your processes. Because using AI to do something the same way you've been doing it for 10 years, it's just, you're just wasting an extraordinary opportunity to rethink the way the business works. So I think a lot of financial institutions would be better served by taking one end-to-end workflow or one process, focusing on that, really getting that cleaned up and dialed in, and then looking at the journey they went on to get that done, and then applying that horizontally across the organization instead of saying to every single team, just go do a bunch of stuff with AI and keep what works and, you know, abandon what doesn't. I think that's a challenging kind of way to try and operate the portfolio.
Yeah. I would agree with that for sure. Adam, one thing that really interests me is all this talk about, you know, what is responsible AI? I know you've made the argument that trust in AI isn't primarily a values question. It's really more of a who is accessing what and why. And if you don't have a foundation, if you can't answer that question, you don't have a foundation of responsible AI. So how do you think that changes the way that financial institutions should think about personalization, which you've mentioned before?
Yeah, I think it's a lot like any time you have a technology problem. You can blame the technology or you can blame the technology vendor. But at the end of the day, if you pull on the string, there's a person or a group of people. And so if you can't point to what your agents are doing or algorithms are doing and saying, this is the name of the human being that would be responsible if we're not happy with the outcomes, then you don't have the most basic accountability structure laid out that's going to make you effective. And so this notion of governance, which is a word that drives me nuts because I can't ever get a clear definition from anybody about what it is. But this notion of governance has to start with who is ultimately responsible. And you have to make sure that the decision-making about what you do or don't do lines up with the people that are responsible for how things get done or not done. And that you are putting the teams that have the ability to assure that you get the intended outcomes at the intended level of quality. You know, you've got to give them autonomy and control, for lack of a better word, over how things are achieved and how that progresses. Delivering a lot of AI and then having issues with it, whether they're data quality issues, model issues, hallucinations, governance, unexpected outcomes, and then saying, well, you know, I just don't know how this happened. I guess it's a technology problem. That's just ridiculous. Like, I'm not sure I'm thrilled with OpenAI's response to the way that their most recent model broke out of their sandbox and went and compromised Hugging Face. That is not a great outcome for anybody. And I don't know if I would say they're not taking it seriously, but that's a pretty substantial failure of fundamental accountability if you're creating this thing and you're not actually taking real responsibility for the outcomes that arise as a result of, you know, the work that you've done. It's not good enough to just craft Frankenstein's monster and then, you know, wring your hands when it wanders off into the village and sets things on fire and throws children around. You have to have a notion of being able to exercise some degree of control and provide some guarantees around how this stuff works. And I think the banking industry is one in which people take that very, very seriously, whether it's around accuracy of balances or tracing of transactions or compliance with regulations. And there's a real collision culturally between the Silicon Valley culture and the culture of banking. And I think that can be mediated and I think it can be negotiated out, but you've got to focus on the eventual outcomes and you have to have the people that are responsible for them know that they're really responsible. And then you have to trust them when they say that they know the right ways to do things.
Right, exactly. You know, this is kind of a more personal question, but AI, you know, it's fundamentally changing what it means to be a technologist. And you are living that in real time as a CTO. How is your role and really the role of technical teams inside financial institutions changing and evolving? And what does that tell us about how banks and credit unions should be building for an AI-powered future?
Yeah, for me at least, because I've always felt like my focus was on harnessing what was available in technology to achieve human-centric outcomes, I don't feel like there's been a big shift. The shift I'm perceiving is that for as long as I've been doing IT or computing or software engineering work, it was presumed that it was really hard to generate good code. It was really hard to generate good designs. It was really hard to do good penetration testing. All those mechanical things were difficult, and you would get people who were very, very good at it, and you would pay them a lot of money, and they would take a long time to do it. And a lot of our processes in the space around technology, the way we test, the way we deploy, the way we think about things, are built around it taking a long time to construct a piece of software. Now that you can construct a piece of software very rapidly for much, much less cost, whether it's opportunity cost or, you know, Ross calendar cost or dollar cost, it changes the dynamic around what becomes possible. And notions around curation and governance and thoughtfulness in design become much, much more important. And so I think it's different to be a technologist because one of the most fundamental constraints in what you could do with software to impact people's actual lives has, I wouldn't say been removed, but been substantially lowered. But I don't think it changes in any way the fundamental North Star, which is the point of technology should be to make people's lives easier and better and more fulfilling. And that, I think, should not change and hopefully has not changed for most technologists. And so I think, again, there's an interesting paradox there, which is how do we keep the values we had in a pre-AI world around the way we think about technology, but adapt to the insane velocity that appears to be possible when using code generation and other kinds of AI-assisted tech. And that shift from a low velocity to a high velocity environment, I think, is driving a lot of reevaluation about how you could work and what you could do. Because something that was traditionally difficult and expensive now feels much, much less expensive. But, you know, shipping software, delivering software, maintaining software, securing software, product management, good design, those things are less expensive, but they're not radically less expensive the way it is just the manufacturing of software. And that that schism, I think, is driving a lot of people to kind of really try and reconsider the way software engineering as a discipline is practiced.
Is that, do you consider that kind of a cultural issue and where you need leadership to kind of step in and demonstrate this? Or where is a bubble up from the bottom by hiring very, very smart computer science people?
I think, you know, I think it's a leadership issue, and I think it's a function of hiring for a broader sort of intelligence. You know, we ran a program at Q2 for a few years where we said, we want to hire engineers, but we don't want to hire any computer science grads. This did not make me very popular at universities in the city of Austin, Texas. But we went out into the market and said, if you've got these skills and you have the desire to learn software engineering, we'll teach you. But we just kept getting resumes that looked very similar. They looked similar demographically. They looked similar culturally. They looked similar in terms of the way in which people thought about problems. And a lot of us on the team had come from non-traditional, non-CS backgrounds. You know, my background is graduate level economics, which I wouldn't inflict on anybody, but is actually pretty useful if you work in the technology space. And so I think leadership has a responsibility to ensure that we're using these tools in a way that is aligned with the values of the organization and the way the organization thinks about its purpose in the world. And I also think that that leadership has a responsibility to attract lots of different kinds of smart, if that makes sense. Not just computer science smart, not just algorithmically smart, but also people who understand, you know, the interplay of human relationships, people who have empathy for end users and account holders, people who understand interior organizational dynamics, people that are brilliant at design, whether it's graphic design or interaction design or incentive design. All of those things are important and they all matter. And now that we're in a world where it's much cheaper to manufacture and test and to some extent deploy software experiences, the relative economic return to being good at all that other stuff is higher. This is just, I mean, this is a known economic principle. If one input into a process gets cheaper, the value of the other input actually goes up. It's one of the most fascinating things about modern capitalism that is on the good side of the ledger. And so we've got to make sure that we have broadly diverse talent in the sense of thinking differently, coming from different perspectives, coming from different backgrounds to apply to these kinds of problems, because that broader approach and that intersection of conflicting kinds of intelligence and perspectives on the problem produces much more viable outcomes than just one kind of talent or one kind of thinking.
That is really interesting. And that is good news for all the people that studied economics and English or history or others have other skills.
Bring me a poet to fight with the robot. You know what I mean? Like, I have enough mathematicians now. Like, it all has value.
Right. That's great. I have one final question for you, Adam. And I know that you've said that the most important AI choices a financial institution makes isn't about picking the best technology. It's instead about whether those choices are really aligned with how that institution wants to serve. It comes down to the community, right? So that's a different success metric than most people are using. So what do you think winning looks like for a community bank or a credit union, let's say 5 years from now?
Yeah. So I will pre-admit my bias as a bit of a contrarian. And I will tell you, I don't like a focus on revenue. I like to think of revenue as proof of delivered value. And so if you walk backwards from all these financial metrics and all these traditional metrics of success, which are very useful and they're important, and I'm not arguing for dismantling them, but if you really think underneath, if you are capturing customers and capturing revenue, and even that language is kind of gross. We have all this gross language around business. Anyway, if you are embracing customers and you have the revenue as the proof that you are creating value for them, then you would want to do more of that. And if you have a culture that's centered around enabling a community and creating opportunity within that community, that should be your focus. And you need all the metrics around efficiency and, you know, loan growth and deposit growth and efficiency and all those other kinds of things. But at the end of the day, what you want is an organization that has concrete evidence that it is making the world a better place for the people that interact with that company. And that means employees and customers, account holders and investors and leadership and management. And that as a North Star, I think leads to a different kind of decision-making than a fetishistic focus on the set of metrics that is clearly and definitively observable. And so what does success look like in 5 years for a credit union or a bank? They have won and embraced more customers and members in the market. They are delivering a broader array of products in a more effective way. They necessarily will have more revenue or more profit, whichever measure or both you prefer. And they will have done so while leaning harder into their core mission and serving their community than they were able to do in previous years, because they have used the technology to become more of what they already are, more of what they know themselves to be. I think any company that understands who they are and what they are and really brings that to the table when they serve customers and make decisions will benefit from AI in a way that companies that are confused about their value proposition and their culture and their values, because AI is an accelerator and it will amplify whatever you are today. If you are disorganized, AI will probably make you more disorganized. If you are culturally aligned and you have a North Star that drives your customers and your employees in a particular direction, you will probably get more of that. And so AI it's a little more of everything for everybody. And the most successful organizations will find a way to be truer to their values and their culture and all of their fundamental operative success metrics at the same time.
Great. I'm sad to say that that's all the time that we have today, because we there's probably more challenges and issues that we could get into. But I think I myself, and I'm sure our listeners, really appreciate your very thoughtful answers to these big, challenging issues surrounding AI. So thank you, Adam.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on today. This was really great.
Yeah, we appreciate it. And thank you all for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit q2.com and have a great day. Thanks.